We turn now to an important legal case which was tried in 2008 involving organ donation after cardiac death. It highlights many of the points that we've been raising. It involved a young man named Ruben Navarro, a 25-year-old individual who had adrenoleukodystrophy, a very severe and unrelenting deteriorating illness of the central nervous system, which eventually resulted in his being in a nursing home and had resulted sometime before in his having had a seizure disorder. Although, as the picture indicates, earlier in his life he had been able to manage to be in school. But at this point, at 25 years of age, he was in his last weeks of life. He had been transferred to a nursing home where he was found to be unconscious and then was admitted to an acute care facility, Sierra Vista Hospital, and placed on life support. He was determined to be comatose, without any hope of recovery. He was never diagnosed as being brain dead. And after a consultation with his mother, it was decided that he could be an organ donor for organ donation after cardiac death. Now, his mother, Rosa Navarro, made it clear that she never completely understood what this entailed, and indeed the question of the circumstances of her giving formal consent for this procedure were very obscure. At one point, the documentaries and legal discussions suggested that one of the representatives of the organ procurement agency claimed that she had given verbal consent on the phone while she was on the train, having visited her son relatively recently and still being very anguished and concerned and even confused about what his situation was. His mother did not live near him and had to take a train back and forth to get to the hospital where he was hospitalized. But in any case, the decision was made to attempt organ donation after cardiac death, which meant that he would be taken to the operating room and life support, his respirator, would be discontinued. The transplant team arrived after significant delays, and by the time they arrived, the physicians responsible for taking care of Ruben were no longer in the hospital. However, he was transferred to the operating room. And it should be noted that neither the critical care nurse, Diana Stevens, who was involved then, nor his attending physician, the physician who would have been responsible for the palliative care at the end of life, Laura Lubarsky, were familiar with protocols for organ donation after cardiac death. It had not previously been done at this hospital. Dr. Lubarsky was not present when the transplant team arrived, although she did arrive a little later. As noted, if you drop down to the section highlighted on the page, attempted organ donation after cardiac death, this occurred on February 23rd in 2006. The transplant nurse, Carla Albright, appears to have been one of the first to arrive. She examined the chart and the patient, and she ordered the nurse, Diana Stevens, who was a nurse at the hospital, to administer 20 milligrams of morphine in the intensive care unit. However, there was no documented evidence of any kind of distress on the part of the patient. So the question naturally arises, why this very large dose of morphine, and those familiar with palliative care would probably raise their eyebrows at this point, because this kind of a dosage is very significantly high and in the absence of any evidence of any kind of distress. Over an hour, an additional 180 milligrams of morphine and 80 milligrams of the drug Ativan, which has the effect of potentiating, that is, increasing and rendering more effective the effects of the morphine, were administered by Nurse Stevens on orders from Dr. Ruzrock, who was the transplant surgeon. So we now have the highly unusual, indeed actually forbidden by protocols, context of the physician who will be performing the removal of organs now caring for the patient at the end of life, effectively providing what would have been regarded as palliative care. And naturally, people reviewing the records wondered why such large doses of medication were being given in the absence of any indication of distress on the part of the patient. The patient had not been conscious for quite some time. In fact, he had not been conscious during his hospital stay, apparently. and this is exactly the reason why this case was eventually prosecuted. At one point, Dr. Ruzraq admitted that he described the drugs that were being given as candy for the individual, which struck those standing around as unusual and even flippant. Another unusual thing is that at one point, apparently, Dr. Ruzraq ordered that betadine, which is an antiseptic solution, be administered via the feeding tube. No one is, to this day, quite clear why this was done, and in fact, betadine is a toxic substance when administered by that route. Eventually, Ruben's physician did arrive, Dr. Lubarsky. She found herself unable to interfere with the care that was being offered, and states that she deferred to the experts who were there, and she presumed that they knew what the protocols were. She was alarmed at one point when Dr. Ruzraq took Navarro's pulse and suggested that although the monitors were still showing that he had an EKG, that he had electrical activity in his heart, he felt that the heart was probably not beating. But Dr. Lubarsky, who was in attendance, noticed that she could see evidence of his heartbeat in his uncovered chest, and that she heard the heart beating when she examined him. So despite the fact that the respirator had been discontinued, Ruben did not die, even after being given these very large doses of medication, which would normally have the effect of suppressing respiration. And this was the contention on the part of the district attorney who eventually prosecuted the case, that it appeared that Dr. Ruzraq was giving medication not so much with the intention of treating symptoms, but in fact of deliberately intending to hasten death. And so, in the fall of 2007, if you drop down, the Sierra Vista Medical Center settled with Ruben's mother. I should mention that Ruben died 7 hours after the life support was discontinued, and he had been returned to the intensive care unit, and eventually he was not an organ donor at all. But in the fall of 2007, there was a settlement with the medical center, with the patient's mother and the center, and there was a criminal proceeding initiated against Dr. Ruzraq in February of 2008. Initially, the district attorney noted that this was the first case that such a criminal case had been initiated against a transplant doctor in the U.S. He was at first charged with, number one, dependent adult abuse, number two, unlawful prescribing of a drug, that is, prescribing a controlled substance without a legitimate medical need, and third, administering a harmful substance, betadine. Eventually, the prosecution apparently determined that the second and third complaints would probably not be prosecutable, so they were dropped, and so he was tried on one felony count of abuse of an adult. There were several documentaries which were produced at this time and later. The most vivid and perhaps best known of them was entitled A Matter of Time. It aired after the trial was completed in January of 2010. Most of these portrayed, as I've noted, Dr. Ruzraq as a very noble crusader for the cause of organ transplantation who was being persecuted by the district attorney for having done everything in his power to prevent Ruben from experiencing pain. Of course, the contention on the part of the DA was that the transplant surgeon had given drugs with the intention of hastening the patient's death. In December of 2008, the jury concluded that Dr. Ruzraq was innocent of dependent adult abuse, and I've included here an article from the Los Angeles Times that attempted to summarize the case and its various implications, and I'd invite you to take a look at that article at your leisure. I don't intend to discuss it here. It recounts most of the points that we've been discussing. If you drop down further, I've noted that many of the ethical issues that are raised here are the question of organ transplantation itself, palliative sedation, and in particular, who should be administering it, what constitutes compassion and care for the dying, and what is respect for the dead, what happens when there is a professional conflict of interest, when the transplant surgeon is giving drugs to the patient who is dying. What about the issue of patient autonomy, the issue of the mother acting as Reuben's surrogate, and to what extent was informed consent present? We've noted that organ procurement agencies very often are convinced that organ donation is the moral thing to do, and that enabling the patient or their surrogate to make a free and informed consent does not often constitute what it is that they're encouraging, but rather they often regard themselves as having the moral right to strongly encourage the individual to do what they regard as the right thing. And then the question of authority over the patient, who really is the attending physician, and when do these roles change? And I've noted that the conclusions, which I think everybody, even those who disagree on whether Dr. Ruzrock acted appropriately, would agree that protocols must be clear, they must be followed. All members of the team who are caring for the dying patient should feel comfortable with these protocols, especially the attending physician and those who will accompany the patient to the OR and carry on the palliative care. And everyone should accept the fact that this approach may occasionally waste the time of the transplant team and especially of the transplant surgeon. It's been estimated that approximately 20% of patients who are thought to be eligible for organ donation after cardiac death will not be, because after their respirators are turned off, they do not die within the accepted period of time, whatever the protocols are set for. And the patients will then expire eventually, but back in the intensive care unit rather than in the operating room. And again, our reasons for considering this legal case were to remind us of the importance of the protocols we've discussed and of the kinds of pastoral issues that can arise during the question of organ transplantation after cardiac death. This highlights particularly the question of informed consent and the obtaining of informed consent by the patient's surrogates, and it also raises again the question of where death takes place and pastoral issues surrounding the care of the dying and the normal sort of care that would be offered to someone who is expiring under these circumstances.